And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Yesterday, Huma Abedin, one of Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton's top aides, said she was separating from her husband, Anthony Weiner, after a sex scandal similar to an earlier incident that led him to resign from the U.S. Congress. Her announcement follows a New York Post report that happened on the weekend that Weiner recently sent photos of his boxer brief-clad genitals, one while he was in bed with their toddler son via Twitter, to another woman. The photos were evidently part of a month-long exchange between Weiner and the woman. Many messages were of a sexual nature. Now, we remember Anthony Weiner resigned. That was back in 2011 from Congress, where he was representing New York City, a district there in New York City, following a sexting scandal in which he accidentally posted an explicit photo of himself in his public Twitter timeline instead of via a direct message to a woman, as he had intended to do. Joining us to comment on sexting, but also other new forms of sexuality combining with new technology, Meenakshi Jijidurum is with us, University of Iowa professor of journalism and mass communication and gender, women's, and sexuality studies, recently publishing a book titled Technosex. If I can get this further title right, I hope I can. Technosex, the Precarious Corporeal Realities, Mediated Sexualities, and the Ethics of Embodied Techniques, came out just this summer. Jijidurum, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Ben. It's good to be here.
Let's talk specifically about sexting. What is the appeal of sexting? Sending explicit photos of yourself via text.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a really interesting question. I've studied, I've looked at sexting more among adolescents than among adults, but so there's similar things at work, though. For adolescents in particular, though, it's a form of intimacy for them, and for adults as well, right? So people used to write love letters to each other. So it's sort of, you know, in many people's view, it's a kind of intimate exchange between consenting partners. I mean, that's sort of the if you will, the best form of sexting.
Should we understand it as a sexual encounter or as a type of precursor or courting?
It can be. I think it can be viewed as a type of courting in many instances, especially among teens. And some of the research about sexting, sort of indicates that teens say things like, "We're not having sex. We're sexting." So they don't actually see it as sex itself. They see it as a sort of courtship or a precursor to it. And actually, in some ways, they also see it as safe because it doesn't actually involve, you know, they've grown up in an abstinence-only sort of era. They've grown up in a, you know, time where they're being warned repeatedly about the dangers of sexual activity and so on. And so they see sex as a sort of safer way to engage in a behavior that obviously they're very interested in, being adolescents and mm-hmm. so on. So
they're looking for this intimacy, mm-hmm. But also safety, yep. And they don't want to be, when they're asked, have you had sex as a 15, 16-year-old, mm-hmm. they want to be able to say no, and they, right. In their mind, they can say yeah.
Right, exactly. And so, I mean, in one sense, I can, you know, in the physical sense of, you know, not being exposed to, unplanned pregnancies or STIs or something like that, it's safe. But in another sense, it's not that safe because obviously, you know, these photographs do sometimes, you know, get disseminated beyond the intimate partner that they would like it to go to. And then the repercussions can be very severe for teens, but also for adults, as we see in the case of Anthony Weiner.
Mm-hmm. What is your research or what are your thoughts on how this technology, we want to talk about some other aspects of technology, are changing sexuality?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, actually, that's sort of what my book is focused on, because it's really interesting the ways in which our engagements with technology are kind of influencing the ways in which we conceive of desire and the ways that we act it out in various ways. You know, so for example, this the whole phenomenon of cyber sex. In a sense, it's perhaps similar to the way people used to consume pornography. But in another sense, it's certainly like moving people towards engaging in sexual practices in ways that are actually not engaged with other real people. So it's very different in that way. And it can also, right now, I mean, there's no clear diagnosis or anything like that, but psychologists are sort of debating issues of cyber sex addiction and those sorts of things, which, you know, may be something that we can think of in relation to mm-hmm. Anthony Weiner's activities.
Right. When you have an addiction, and I know you're not a psychologist here, looking at these things too. So I'm just trying to think about what cyber sex or sexting does it sort of is a safe way, in a certain way, a safe way, and it removes, you can remain, well, you don't remain anonymous. You think you may.
That's right.
In some cases.
Yeah.
So it kind of cuts out some of the procedures, the foreplay, if you will, the courting that happens and gets to a certain point in the relationship.
Yeah, actually, it's really interesting because, you know, several studies, several people who study these kinds of phenomena talk about the AAA engine that drives online affairs or online sexual activity, and it has nothing to do with automobiles. AAA refers to accessibility, affordability, and anonymity, or the perception of anonymity. And those are the three things that really, you know, seem to attract people to these kinds of behaviors online. So it's easily accessible. You know, almost everyone, you know, especially in a developed country, has access to these sorts of technologies now. It's affordable because, you know, sexting is free, and so is a lot of other online sites of this nature. And there's a perception of anonymity. People think they can do it without disclosing their identity. Sometimes they can, but sometimes there are unforeseen consequences where their identities are revealed.
Okay, identities revealed, but what does law say about sexting? Anthony Weiner sending a crotch shot out on Twitter back in 2011. Is that a state laws, federal laws? What's the deal there?
Yeah, right. And again, I'm not a lawyer, and maybe there are lawyers listening who can give us some more precise, you know, a sort of answer to that question. I have looked at, because my area of expertise tends to be youth cultures and adolescence, and so actually the laws on minors engaging in cyber sex practices are very interesting. They vary quite widely, but in many states, they actually use child pornography statutes to prosecute kids involved in sexting, and so the penalties are very extreme and very harsh for engaging in this kind of behavior.
Just as an example, you could have a 17-year-old high schooler sexting to someone else, a 17-year-old or a 16. They're both minors, and the one who sent the photo would be accused, perhaps put to, you know, have punishment for child pornography.
Yeah, absolutely. The one who sent the photo, the one who received the photo, and if that photo gets disseminated further, then more people are involved. And yes, the child pornography laws are the ones that are brought into play in many states. Now, several states have enacted legislation to help differentiate between child pornography and sexting by minors, but that still hasn't been fully worked out. And so some kids who are engaging in these behaviors could get really, really serious.
I happen to know what the state of those laws here in Iowa are.
Oh, actually, I don't.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about some of the other aspects you explore in your book. Mm-hmm. How we represent sex in the media and advertising.
Yeah.
How is this changing in recent years?
Yeah, well, I mean, for one thing, of course, as everyone's probably noticed, it's gotten more and more explicit.
And everywhere.
Yeah, and everywhere. It's ubiquitous. We live in a media-saturated environment, and a lot of that media imagery is of sexuality and desirability. And, I mean, in my book, I sort of coined the term the sexscape to describe this environment, because it's everything from sort of Victoria's Secret posters when you walk through a mall to, you know, billboards, you know, when you're driving on an interstate highway, you know, billboards for gentlemen's clubs or whatever. And so it's kind of everywhere. And in a sense, and so one of the things that I'm looking at is the way that media images of desirability are shaping our concepts of what that means, right? So, I mean, it used to be like that sexual attraction was something that was very, sort of intimate between two people, you know. Who can predict what the chemistry between two people, you know, might be. And there's something sort of wonderful and magical about that. But when it's being driven by corporate interests, then there's a very sort of fixed notion of what desirability is, right? And it tends to, you know, there tends to be certain racial characteristics that are associated with the desirable figure. There are certain, there's youth, there's slenderness, there's, especially for women, there's a certain physical type that's absolutely impossible to achieve without in real life, right? Because the images are completely digitally manipulated.
So what you're saying is that the spectrum of what is desirable perhaps in the past used to be larger. Mm-hmm. We included more things in this, and now Madison Avenue says this is a desirable face, this is a desirable body, these are desirable breasts or whatever.
Yep, exactly. And it's very much driven by sort of corporate interests, because obviously in order to achieve, those the you know those characteristics, you have to engage in an awful lot of consumerism, right? You have to buy, you know, for example, well, you may have to. Some people do, you know, engage in very expensive procedures, you know, again, technological procedures using medical technologies like breast augmentation, like rhinoplasty, like you know, there are even you know, the eyelid surgeries or mm-hmm. there are even leg lengthening procedures, you know, things like that. And then you also have to, you know, buy an awful lot of products, cosmetics and Spanx undergarments and stiletto heels and whatever it is, you know, it's all mm-hmm. sort of, it all drives you towards this kind of consumerism in order to achieve that desirability. Mm-hmm.
With all these, the advances, if you want to call them advances, mm-hmm. these changes mm-hmm. In terms of sexuality in the, mm-hmm. in the 21st century with all this new technology, mm-hmm. anything, your thoughts on how that influences the satisfaction, happiness with a person's own sexuality?
Yeah, I mean, that's very interesting, too, because there are some findings from the literature that show that, for example, you know, people who engage in you know, sort of addictive cybersexual behavior, their real world relationships do get impacted by that. You know, that they're, for example, you know, less likely to actually be able to feel desire for real people.
Or they say they get used to the online type mm-hmm. of sex, and they say this other stuff, the real world stuff, just too difficult.
Yep, too difficult.
Too many hoops to jump.
Yep, or maybe these women don't look pretty enough, you know, because they're not, obviously they're not these kinds of, you know, fabricated images of mm-hmm. sort of ideal mm-hmm. womanhood. So,
if you've just joined us, Gigi Durham, my guest, the University of Iowa professor of journalism and mass communication, also gender, women's, and sexuality studies at the University of Iowa. Her new book, Techno Sex. You talk about in your book, you write about it, sexscapes. What are they?
Yeah, so the way I conceive of sexscapes is they are the sort of, you know, media saturated environment that we live in that is so filled with images of desire, of desirability, right? The whole environment in which people enact sexuality these days, because, you know, as we're pointing out, there's sexting behaviors, there's you know, people going into adult chat rooms, there's, you know, just engagement with you know, pornographic sites online, and then there's just the whole you know, the physical environment. You know, you're driving along, you see the billboards, you know, walking through the mall, you see the posters. So it's that whole environment of sort of mediated sexuality that, you know, mm-hmm. that we experience these days.
And we measure ourselves by that.
Yes.
And these, mm-hmm. what we often see are digitized bodies,
totally.
Right? And so they're perfect, and it makes us feel...
Yep, inadequate.
you focus on feminism a lot in your book. Mm-hmm. What are there are also pressures on men here in terms of body image, right?
Oh,
Yeah,
I mean, you know, still statistically, sort of women experience body dissatisfaction and eating disorders and things at a far larger rate than men. But actually, the numbers among men are growing, which is sort of not the direction.
And these eating disorders are connected with our view of ourselves in terms of sexuality?
Yeah, there's actually some evidence of that, too, that people who, you know, who even in experimental situations when they're exposed to these kinds of ideal images, they're body dissatisfaction drops, and there is a correlation between the incidence of eating disorders and exposure to media. In fact, maybe I hope this isn't too much of a tangent, but there's a very, very interesting study by a group of Harvard anthropologists who were in the South Pacific island of Fiji prior to the introduction of Western television, and there was no incidence of eating disorders among adolescent girls. And then when Western TV came in, and this was in the late 90s, so it was shows like Baywatch with Pamela Anderson in her swimsuit, suddenly there was eating disorders began to occur among adolescent girls in Fiji. And so it was this amazing field experiment that showed an absolute relationship between media images and eating disorders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wanted to play a little bit, a clip when I heard we were going to have this conversation, Gigi, a film that leapt to mind was from the 1970s. Boomers will remember this, a Woody Allen film from 1973 called Sleeper. And in among many of the funny things in Sleeper are, so it imagine this is a person who falls asleep for what, a couple hundred years?
I can't remember.
Something like
years
that.
Ago.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, so Woody Allen wakes up in the future, and this is a film also with Diane Keaton. And so in the future, as imagined in this 1973 film, people, help me here again, people don't really have sex with each other old fashioned. They need a piece of technology called the orgasmatron. Here's a little clip from that 1973 film, the Woody Allen film, just so we get a sense of how people deal with the orgasmatron.
Oh, that was wonderful. I feel so refreshed. I think we should have had sex, but there weren't enough people.
We'll use the orgasmatron.
That's a good idea.
Come on.
You know, I think everybody knows the plot tonight.
Oh, I Oh, it's such a good time.
All in all, I thought the party came off quite well. Certainly as good as last night to the night before's. Maybe not quite as good as last Saturday's, but you know something, Harold? I love a party with the thing.
Okay, so the orgasmatron, sort of a phone a round phone booth looking thing that obviously the characters in this film step into very briefly. Which leads me to the question as we end this conversation here, got about 5 minutes left, Gigi. So where do you see all this heading? We're accelerating in technology, in the way we consume news, and all other forms of where technology intersects with our lives. What about sexuality? What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, so I think honestly we're going to be sort of more and more involved with or tangled up with technology in terms of our sexuality. Already porn is one of the top five most searched terms on Google, you know, still. And so, actually there are around 55 million documented sex-related online searches in, you know, in a year. So, I mean, I don't think it's going to abate at all. So what I do think and what I do argue in my book is that we need to develop sort of, you know, more awareness of all of this. We need to be alert to this sexscape and to think about, you know, sort of what the ethics of this kind of online sexual activity might be. You know, so for example, getting back to Wiener's case, his involvement in cyber sex has destroyed his relationship with his spouse, obviously. And again, I'm not a social worker, but just the fact that he sexted an image that involved his very young son, you know, seems to me to have compromised the child's safety and well-being in certain ways.
Certainly.
And
mm-hmm.
It makes me question, you know, his capability as a parent. Just me personally, I would be asking those kinds of questions. I think we really need to be thinking hard about ethics in the sexscape and how, you know, the online and the offline are tangled up together and they impact one another hugely. And so how are our online sexual activities, affecting our real lives? Those mm-hmm. are the questions.
When we talk about ethics and sexuality in this new mm-hmm. media world,
yeah.
what specifically sort of questions come to your mind when yeah. we talk about the ethics?
Yeah, so I really want to think, and in my book I do sort of outline this framework where we have to think about relationships of power, which operate in the real world but also operate online. Because
sure.
I think a lot of people think of the online environment as sort of this place of wonderful freedom where you can engage in all these different kinds of behaviors that might be taboo in real life and that you can experience them sort of freely and it's okay and everything's good and you don't deal with, as you pointed out earlier, the kind of messiness of you know, real relationships. But in truth, all of those power relationships that operate offline also operate online, and the ways in which the online environment is used for sexuality, you know, has implications that need to be thought through. So in one way, there are online sexual environments that I think can be very progressive and very good, you know, and so, for example, LGBT teenagers who can't come out in their real environments or people who might be of minority sexual orientations and live in countries where that sort of behavior is taboo can, you know, find networks and find support online that they can't. And those are good things. You know, I'm not saying that the whole online sex environment is bad. On the other hand, though, the cybersexual environment makes, for example, internet child pornography a lot more, you know, a lot easier. And the main victims of those kinds of practices are in, the global south and non-Western, resource-poor countries. And so the exploitation of those children and women, people in those situations, is actually enabled and, you know, intensified by the internet. So I feel like we definitely have to think about that, you know, in mm-hmm. the way that power runs through these relationships online and offline.
So you can see both mm-hmm. positive uses of technology, inter-technology, and also the downside, the dark side of this as well, and that will continue on into the future.
Very much so.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You talked about addiction there. Do we mean that as a sort of a clinical sense of addiction? How does someone know, for instance, if they're addicted?
Yeah, that's really interesting, too, because psychologists are actually grappling with that very question. Right now, there was internet sex addiction, cyber sex addiction, even sex addiction, those are not actually they're not in the DSM-5, for example. They're not formal diagnoses. There was some discussion of including hypersexual disorder in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, but they decided not to do it because there's not much research on it right now. So usually, you know, what psychologists say is that internet addiction involves a preoccupation with online activities leading to negative outcomes. And so, you know, they're looking at you know, the kinds, and cybersex addiction refers to compulsive and often extreme variants of sexual internet behaviors producing negative individual consequences. So they're really looking at, you know, when these kinds of behaviors have negative impacts in the real world, then you have to sort of consider them in terms of addiction. But whether they're formally addictions, the psychologists are still thinking about that.
But in common with other addictions, whether it be substance abuse or whatever, gambling, for instance, when it starts to destroy your relationships, it destroys, when there's that negative impact on your life, that's a sure sign that you may have a problem, right?
Yes, absolutely right. And actually, cybersex has been associated with relationship problems and symptoms of psychological disorders. You know, for example, one study found increases in internet use to predict more symptoms of depression and less time in face-to-face socialization. They've also found internet addiction to be predicted by depression, you know, ADHD, social phobia, hostility, you know, and sometimes they're also even associated with, well, interpersonal, you know, insensitivity, for example, again, as in Wiener's case.
We've run out of time. Yeah. A fascinating area of study. Thank you for bringing some of the aspects to light for us. Meenakshi Sheshidharam, University of Iowa Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication, Gender, Women's, and Sexuality Studies. Her most recent book, Techno Sex, Precarious Corporate Realities, Mediated Sexualities, and the Ethics of Embodied Techniques. And it came out just a little while ago. Sheshidharam, thank you for coming into our studio.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Gray Lanta today. Jason Burns helped out as well. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. Tomorrow, don't miss Politics Day, of course. River to River, a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.